Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
iZotope and Native Instruments have teamed up to create the start-to-finish bundle that home recording guitar nerds have been waiting for. Plus, you, dear listener, get an extra 10% off with Guitar Nerds by using discount code NERDS10 at the checkout on iZotope.com. From the creative spark to the final touch, their new bundles include pretty much everything you could possibly need, which is great because it's far too easy to sink hundreds of pounds and a big chunk of your time into just picking up random plugins. The Music Production Suite 4.1 and Complete 13 bundle contains over 30 intelligent mixing, mastering and repair plugins, 65 premium instruments, 20 plus expansions and over 35,000 sounds. And if that's a bit basic for you, they've also bundled Music Production Suite 4.1 with Complete 13 Ultimate, which gives you everything that makes Complete 13 incredible, plus a colossal library of added synths, sampled instruments and effects, 115 plus premium instruments and effects, 39 Native Instruments expansions and over 65,000 sounds. Whew. It sounds like a lot. It is. It's very good, very comprehensive. And as we've come to expect from iZotope, it's very good value. If you're looking to get into home recording, I cannot recommend it more highly. And if you're already into home recording, it really is the one-stop shop for making what you do sound better. This podcast is entirely treated and produced using iZotope plugins, and Native Instruments have been responsible for almost every synth or sample you've heard on our Guitar Nerds jingles. Check out their great new bundles on iZotope.com or follow links in the description of this podcast and use discount code NERDS10 at the checkout for 10% off anything in the iZotope arsenal. Hello and welcome to the Guitar Nerds Podcast, the world's number one guitar podcast. I am your host, Joe Branton, joined this week by Matt Knight.
Hello, Mr. Joe. We're back. We're back.
That's right. We are. We are back. Dear listener, thank you for bearing with us. We took a week off. There's been a whole dead week in the Guitar Nerd Series 3. I don't think that's ever happened before. I felt really bad about that.
I don't think we've ever missed an episode, Joe.
No, I know.
Even
I know.
When no one could do it and I did an episode by myself.
I know. Terrible. Terrible, really. But yes, we did, dear listener. We took a week off because I was doing a 2-week tour with my band of the UK and Ireland, it worked out. So I managed to have a little break in the first week, so I could come back and record last week's or the week before's podcast. So of course, we talked about a couple of shows that I'd played there in Brighton and London. But now I've gone off, done the Midlands, the North, and then across to Ireland and Northern Ireland, and back again up further north, and then back down.
A globetrotter you are, Joe Branton.
Yes, exactly.
How much have you done of Europe? Have you done much?
We've done quite a lot. Obviously, pre Brexit, we'd go over sort of once. We go over once a year for a tour, and then we'd also do the summer festivals. It's just not possible for UK bands to travel outside of the UK anymore. It costs too much in carnets
to be able to do that now. So you have to kind of really plan things. You can't just like nip over anymore, basically, because it costs so much to get all your equipment insured and your merchandise. It means that you're only ever really going to do it around a release tour, whereas before we might be like, oh, you know, some French promoters offered us a show in Lille, maybe let's book another three shows around that in Belgium and Holland and go and do a long weekend or something, you know. So it used to be able to do that, whereas now you can't. What a ridiculous decision. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Yes, we can't, but at least we got our borders back, eh, guys?
Hey.
But, but yes, so not as much. We are going back over there because, of course, we went over to Ireland, which is EU, so we did pay for a car. And I think I covered this, talked about this a bit a couple of weeks ago. So it costs 660-ish quid to get a carnet to ensure your... to allow you to travel with musical instruments and merchandise into Ireland. But of course we only played four shows over there, which is that plus the ferry, which is just shy of £1,000. It's that's a lot of money to make up across four dates, especially when there's fuel and hotels and food to consider as well. So fortunately the carnet lasts a year, so in March we're going back across to mainland Europe, where we'll do France, Belgium, Germany, all those the sort of fundamental places, and then a little bit later in the year we're going to do an East European tour.
How's the math rock scene treating you in in central mainland Europe?
Yeah, good. You know, math and prog, weird music in general, because we don't just get booked on the math scene. We get booked a lot on the prog scene. Tech metal, sometimes. We count as sort of prog metal or avant-garde metal to some people, which I don't think...
Avant-garde metal. Wow.
So we get on those scenes as well, on those shows, and I think weird music in general has more of a home in mainland Europe than maybe it does in the UK. Slightly less obsessed with Radio 1 outside of our borders, so... and slightly more willing to just listen to things that, you know, you haven't been recommended by... I don't know. I don't know any presenters on Radio 1 anymore.
I'm sure. There's a time and a place when not everyone remembers, but everyone would have listened to Radio 1 for the last time and then gone, ah, there's more sophisticated radio and music out here somewhere. But we all sat there as kids taping the top 40. You can't deny that. There was always in Brighton. I'm guessing you can still get it, Joe. I don't know if you have tuned it, but FIP Radio, which is the French radio station that makes its way across the river from France to Brighton. And I talked to one of my French colleagues at work about it, and he's like, yeah, there's no adverts on FIP. It's just like, and they play everything. Wow. I remember listening to FIP when I first moved to Brighton. They were playing like Frank Zappa at like lunchtime.
Oh, wow.
You're like, oh. but yeah, it's I guess as well in the UK it's so condensed, isn't it? It must be difficult. Like, you really have to spread yourself out to have a fan base in lots of different places, because people are willing to travel for a little bit as well.
It's actually one of the problems speaking to people in the north, even though the towns aren't that close. Manchester and Liverpool tend to struggle with each other because people will go to one place or the other, to see a show rather than being able to play both. We did play both on this tour. And also having Leeds and Sheffield relatively close to Manchester and Liverpool is a big problem, because both Leeds and Sheffield have excellent music scenes. Certainly, dear listener, if you're from those areas in the UK and you disagree with me, I am simply talking about weird instrumental prog and math rock. I'm sure, you know, Manchester and Liverpool probably have great music scenes for some things. They do not for weird music. And they're close enough to sort of Sheffield and Leeds, who are really kind of, you know, absolute national leaders of interesting music at the moment.
I wonder why. What is it about Leeds? What's in the beer over there, Joe? What's in their craft ale and their beanie hats? Well, I'm glad you had a good time. And did you make lots of money and sell lots of records? That's the main thing, Joe.
I tell you what, bear in mind, Matt and dear listener, that we were on the edge of an incredibly bad recession. We sold an awful lot of stuff. We sold out T-shirts.
Wow.
Which is incredible. We bought like 100 T-shirts. We had three left by our last show, which is really nice. That's always nice to do. And we sold a bucket of records, some CDs too, things like that. We almost sold out of one of our older EPs that we'd repressed for this, and the new album we had, you know, a lot of, but that sold really well as well. Honestly, it's like surprising amounts. We did extremely well on merchandise, so that really made the tour worthwhile. And, you know, it was very well attended in general, which is always very nice when you're making weird music and you can still pack out a venue. That's very
was
nice.
Was it mainly people that had come and seen you before, or was there a lot of new faces in the audience?
I think there were quite a few new faces. Yeah, certainly when we did the Irish leg of our tour, we were touring with a band called Bicurious, who are a very good, largely instrumental, kind of more math, more like party math band.
Party math?
yeah, I don't know. Think Battles, and So I Watch You From Afar. Oh, okay. Bands like that. Like, that sort of like bounce around, you know, instrumental bands that occasionally go, woo, that sort of thing.
the band that jumps to mind actually for that is Aberdeeshi Shank.
Right.
Okay. They're kind of that sort of bouncy, everything's really happy.
Yeah. Battles. You know Battles? You ever listen to Battles?
Yes. Yeah. Started off as like a five-piece and now they're a two-piece.
Two-piece, yeah.
everyone knows Battle for that one song though, right? That's
Yeah.
It was like a massive song. Very good song, but yeah. I couldn't even give you a name. I could just pick out the melody.
Yeah.
So what did you end up taking out on tour then, Joe? We did touch on this briefly a couple of weeks ago, but remind ourselves and the listeners what you ended up deciding on for the tour.
I took a nice little lightweight rig out with me. So I took a pair of Ashdown ABM 112s, the Neo cabs. They've got handles in the top. And I tell you what, I virtually didn't carry them out of the van once on tour because everyone liked looking macho because they were so easy to carry both of them at the same time. Made you look really tough going up the stairs, but they were incredibly light. So I virtually didn't ever have to carry my bass rig. And normally I'm touring around a big heavy rig and everyone's like, Joe, you've got to take this and we'll take the thing after it, you know. So that was nice. So I took a pair of those and a tiny little Ashdown original 500 head, which is their little Class D head. It's less than 400 quid to buy, and I was just using it for volume. I'm not really using any of the EQ functionality or anything like that, or even the gain control. And then I'm getting my tone off of a blend of the Boss BC1X compressor, which has given me a lot of sparkle to my bass tone. And then at the right at the other end of the chain, a Sans Amp VT Bass DI.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Okay.
Kind of an Ampeg simulator sort of thing that I'm using just to add. I'm using it relatively flat, just using it to get a bit of Valve-esque grit on my clean sound, a bit of a transparent drive to start it. And then I can, most of the effects are coming from the Boss MS3, and I'm sort of chucking those in, you know, on top of, bit ahead of the Sans amp. So But that was kind of the rig. And then I took the base I used for everything was my custom build Fidelity Stella Rosa base, which I have a Mojo Pickups Dynabase pickup bang in the middle. It's got a little flippable mute kit that I can just, it's like on a push, so I can push that out and it pushes a bunch of foam into the underside of the string so I can get a muffled tone. It just has a master volume, no tone control. Instead of having a tone control, I'm essentially using the push mute kit to get that.
Oh, that's cool.
That sort of sound, which is great.
And that was custom designed for the bass as well, wasn't it? Did he?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, really good because I use it a bunch. And, you know, I was nervous about that because it's obviously a mechanism and I'm playing it for 2 weeks, you know, constantly turning it on and off. You don't want it to break on a show. What if it breaks and gets stuck on? That's going to be a problem for big drive tones, or, you know, so. But it was fine. It was a bit of a baptism of fire because I got that bass back only a week before we went out on tour. So it certainly stood the test. I do this thing at the end of the set. I'd like, there's this big ringing out bit. I take the bass off, I hold it by the strap up in the air and let the note ring out. And then as it finishes, I just let go of the strap. So it just falls onto the floor with a big clang. And that's the finish
that
of the
poor
set.
Poor bass.
I know. But here's the thing, about 4 or 5 shows in, I was playing the bass and I thought it on soundcheck. I was like, God, you know, the action's quite high on that bass because of the mute kit and everything. You have to have the bridge relatively high. So it's not the most comfortable of instruments, but I don't care about the sort of thing. It's fine. But I was like, wow, the action is extraordinarily high. This is a real workout. And I played the show and I was like, yeah, it was relatively tough. You know, certainly with some of the noodly bits I'm doing up the high end, I was like, this is a real effort. I'm basically pressing a full finger length down on every string. My hand was really, really tired by the end, and also tuning all over the place in that show. And I realized at the end of the gig that what must have happened in the show before is when I'd thrown the bass, it landed funny, and I'd essentially... I tell you what, I was looking down the neck and being like, it's fine, like the neck's got a fine angle on it, I don't understand what's wrong. And then I looked at the back and realized I'd obviously knocked it and had threaded the screws on the back plate, so the neck was pushing forward. There was only two screws left in the back plate. It was nearly sort of hanging, the neck was nearly coming off. So
imagine if it had come off in the gig.
I know, the bass would have just folded in on itself halfway through the show.
Brilliant.
Which, would not
absolutely
have been good.
Brilliant. And what about the rest of the band? I mean, obviously maybe not so much sax and keys, unless there was any interesting pedals
not,
on there.
No, well, I mean, the sax player is playing through, you know, he uses a Pog and a bunch of other things, but nothing really, you know, nothing to write home about. Seymour Duncan Vapor Trails is his delay of choice, which sounds great. But no, our guitarist Tim was using a switch between, he's got his signature model, obviously, dear listener, we spoke about his signature model Fidelity JB Light bass, which has his Mojo Pickups humbucker size P90 in the bridge. It has a built-in unlatched kill switch and it has a toggle for full tone or no tone as well, which is rather cool. So he was using that guitar for pretty much everything, but we have a couple of songs in Fripp standard tuning, so perfect fifths. And for that, he has a Silverburst Epiphone SG, just one of the cheap. He loves Silverburst, so he got it because, you know, it was a limited edition color and it was just, you know, your standard Epiphone standard. But because it was right-handed, he's ripped out all the controls of it so that he doesn't nudge them because he plays left-handed. So all the controls are missing, so when you plug it in, it's just on immediately. There's no volume control or anything like that, or tone control. And he's taken out the neck pickup. And he did have a P90 that had fitted in the bridge, and he really wasn't getting on with it just before. So a few days before we went out, he dug out like the old Epiphone. It was one of those Epiphones that has like pickups designed by Gibson, and whatever the pro bucker is. And he just fitted in, soldered in the Gibson pro bucker in the bridge. It sounded great, and it sounded so good that it got a lot of compliments about the tone of that guitar. It's just, you know, I think that guitar costs $399 new, you know.
Wow.
And it did sound really good. And he was using his Fender bass breaker, the 15...
The one that you bought in by mistake?
Yes. That one. He actually really got on with that amp now. So it's the, whatever it's called, the 1830, was it 1840, I think? 1830, I think it's called. Yeah. So it switches between 18 and 30 watts. Fender's attempt at making a Vox-style amp, so EL84 valves instead of the 6L6s that you'd normally see in a power stage for a Fender amp. Mm-hmm. And it was great. Obviously, it weighs a ton, you know, and you have to have the volume on like 2, and it's still, you know, very giggable. But for Tim's very thin, very mid-focused sound, it was extremely good. And I think he got on with it very well.
Nice.
So, yeah, that was good. And his pedal board's very simple. He's relying a lot more on things off of the MS3 these days. But his cornerstone drive tones were the Red Beard effects. Angry Rhubarb,
okay,
which he pretty much has on all the time. Sounds just a fantastic pedal for cutting through a mix.
Because of that shapeable. Well, yes. You've got three. Is it three EQs on the Angry Rhubarb pre, it's post, and
three drives? Yeah, three places three that you can boost the gain. Yeah, pre, post, and then there's the you're boosting the frequency. So it's fantastic, and the way Tim does it, you know, within the mix, is getting us to play something and then literally rotating the just the frequency selector with the gain boosted until you can really hear it kind of cutting above everything else, and he uses it for that. It's great. It's a great way to design a drive pedal, and really useful for a thin, for a piercing, cutting, vintage style guitar drive tone.
Did you find that Tim had to really change his sound when you added a keyboard player and a saxophone player because of the frequencies and where he sits in the mix?
Absolutely.
So a pedal like that makes quite a big difference, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, to be honest, like, it was even a comment we made about another band that we saw. I won't name them, obviously, but they were perfectly accomplished musicians, but they were all playing in the same place. Their keys player, their bassist, their guitarist were all like using the same frequency range, and it just meant that out front it was just a mashing of it's not just about learning your instrument when you're in a band, it's learning where your instrument needs to sit in that band.
And that's the tricky thing, I think, with so much gear and so much cool stuff that everyone wants to use, is realistically you focus on how it sounds and not necessarily how you fit in as a band. And I think that's always the key, isn't it? It's like you say, you might have to be happy with a sound that fits in a band mix, but yeah, playing at home, it's not going to, you know, cut the mustard, because you want a thicker, fuller sound with loads of bottom end and loads of top end and loads of mid. And that just doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a band mix, especially live, you know.
Exactly. And it's, you know, dear listener, I've spoken about it a bunch, how the big difference I see between bedroom players or almost just normal people that we interact with as part of guitar nerds, people at guitar shows, collectors, because we're normally all of us playing at home. And there's such a big difference between people who do that and people who gig or maybe tour more than gig. People who put a lot of time into gigging really have to find the gear that works for those situations. And that's where being sparse comes into play, because you have other band members to think about. That's where tour hardiness of equipment comes into play, because it needs to be able to last the amount of time that you're gigging for.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, well, what about the rest of the tour then, Joe? There must have been some interesting gear in the old math rock scene.
Really was. Just because there were so many different types of bands we play with, we could turn up on a bill and they'd be like, yeah, there's like an instrumental tech metal band, you know, or maybe there's like a punk math band this night, or some old 70s style prog band, or, you know, there were just such a broad range of types of players and musicians, which means you see everything from those like math rock bands are people who build their own pedal boards, and like as in the woods, like some untreated ply, and it's a massive board, you know, it'll be huge, it's the size of a desk, there's no controller on it, and it's just tons of pedals, you know. That's, you get that, none of them that good, just they've got lots of them, and they'll have an offset, they'll have some Jaguar or Jazzmaster where they've ripped everything out and shoved like an invader or something in the bridge. You know, you get that type of musician, and then you'll get the guys turning up with their specifically mono gig bags, line six helixes in a sort of a custom made soft case for it. And you know, it will be a Strandberg or something in the case. So you get these two huge other ends and everything in between of musicians. Always really interesting. But the thing I think actually struck me most about this tour is quite a few. By quite a few, I mean maybe no more than a fifth or a sixth of the bands that were playing were either ampless or had a guitarist who was ampless. You know, at least one member that was ampless. Yeah. And I saw a lot of Helix. Sure, there was some Kemper, but Helix was the overriding favourite there. I saw, you know, that played with one band that were bass player and guitarist were Helix, and then just, you know, had a drummer separate.
Do you think that was ease of use, or do you think it was tonality? So a lot of the sounds and things they were creating was like, oh yeah, they're going to do that with a multi-effects, or was it just a case of they can't be bothered to take a bunch of gear to shows?
So recently, Guitar Nerd switched to using Lewitt microphones, specifically the LCT440 condenser mic. Now, this mic is super affordable and very versatile. It's what I'm using right now. In fact, there are a bunch of videos from independent studio engineers with way more audio know-how than me comparing the LCT440 to mics three times its value, and it absolutely holding up. Plus, this mic is as good for instrument capture as it is for podcasting, as it is for vocals, which is great because I don't like messing around with mics, and I can literally use this for everything. The proof is in the pudding, though. So here is my Tweed Blues Junior, recorded at a reasonable room volume using nothing but the Lewitt LCT440. Nothing has been added in post, no compressors or EQs. This is exactly how the Lewitt LCT440 captures the sound of Fender's greatest amplifier. Absolutely pucker. The 440 captures all of the depth and the character of the Blues Junior, and all I had to do was move it over the other side of the office and pop it in front of the amp. So if you're doing anything with home studio vibes, I strongly recommend this wonderful and affordable microphone. Check it out at lewitt-audio.com.
Well, I tell you, it definitely looked a lot easier. The people who got to just, you know, we're there on our, each band member's on their fifth trip up four flights of stairs, you know, with the various stuff. You know, bear in mind, our keys player's got three full-size keyboards in hard cases, you know, and all the rest. The drummer's got a big kit. You know, we carry a lot of stuff on tour. And seeing these bands roll up with like a Helix in a soft bag and a soft bag on their back, being like, yeah, this is all our stuff, we're ready to go, you know. It's obviously ease of use is one thing, but I think the reason that the reason that Helix might be the most popular, certainly within what I'm doing, is price, is because as more stuff has come out, as Neural DSP has come out, as the Boss GT1000 has come out, as Kemper's continued to enhance their units and things, the fact is that you pick up a Helix LT secondhand for £600.
And I just think, I don't know if there was ever necessarily a stigma around using multi-effects, but I definitely think, you know, in one way you can, you know, cut everything in the studio, use them as an interface, and then take the same sound out on the road. And as you say, when you're carving your sort of sonic space, and if your band's got a particular sound and feel, then sort of why wouldn't you?
Some bands did it better than others, and certainly I do still maintain that it works in some cases. Like with the band, we were playing in Birmingham with the first band I saw who were full Helix. That was a three-piece, guitarist playing a Strandberg with a Helix, bass okay. player playing a Spectre, five-string Spectre with a Helix. And the thing that that struck me was it was a 200 cap venue. I was standing at the front and I realized there was just no feel to anything because it's all hitting me from the sides out the front of the PA. Mm. And I went like halfway back and I was like, yeah, this is good. You know, I can hear it from here. And their tones were great. Mm. Well tailored, well put together. The guitarist especially, it was obviously a very well oiled machine, you know, mm-hmm. that he'd really worked it out. But the problem is, in a 200 cap venue, you've got to think, well, if I want to go for it and was at the front trying to rock out, it's just, there's not, you know, I can almost hear your strings, you know. Mm. there's just know your audience. Is now the time? if you want to play crummy 200 cap venues, is now the time for a Helix, or should you at least have something at the back of stage?
What
it loses a lot of feel.
What was the vibe on in-ear monitors? Because obviously, you know, one thing I've noticed, and, you know, you follow quite a few different YouTubers that play in bands mm-hmm. and, you know, going to, you just, that's becoming a way, way more common thing now as well.
Absolutely. Like, yeah. That band in question were on in-ears. I do think it's a kind of an essential for, if you're going to go ampless, you really don't want to be relying on wedge monitors. To be the only way you can hear yourself. So yeah, those were. I saw another band where the rest of the band had amps and one guitarist was ampless, but it was with a Victory on his pedal board, one of the V4s on his pedal board.
Right,
and he was just relying on a wedge monitor.
Wow.
So I don't know how he fed on. It was a larger venue, so it was kind of okay for, you know, to get away with that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But I just wonder how that must have felt on stage when you've got your other band members all with amplifiers up there. It's kind of a weird mix. I don't know if it works doing half of it and half not. Although it sounded great out front. I couldn't fault it, you know. I actually didn't even notice for the first bit that one of the guitarists was ampless. So sound engineer had obviously done a good job, but... But wow. But yeah, so on the question of in-ears, certainly seeing them a lot more than I did.
You're still old school, Joe, I'm guessing.
Still old school. We obviously wear earplugs, but you know that we have custom molded earplugs that have a decibel cut to our taste, sort of thing. But mm-hmm. I don't know. There has been some call for us to move to that sort of thing. I mean, one thing, our sax player, because we have a lot of like. We have two sax parts on a lot of our songs. Our sax player will loop them into a little RC3 and right. then play the second part over them. And our drummer just has a lot of sax coming through his wedge, so he can try and keep in time with that and thus keep the rest of us in time.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, you know, it's a tricky thing to do when you're going into different venues and you don't know what your wedge is going to be like. And you know, if you're playing someone with an analog desk, don't forget this, you're playing someone with an analog desk, they can't save monitor mixes. So you're relying on the sound engineer to be good enough to remember where you'd asked for all those things to be when you know, from gig to sound check.
Yeah, I think that's it as well. I've seen people now that they're taking, like, not only are they taking in-ears, they've got like a little rack flight case that's just got like a little mixer in it, and then like all of the presets are saved, and they literally yeah. turn up and plug in and away you go.
Yeah, it's definitely becoming more popular. I think in-ears are probably a chat for our band. I think I'm getting a bit sick of bad monitor mixes putting me off a performance, you know. But
sort of, well, I mean, it doesn't totally cut out the role of a sound person, but certainly means that they have to do less.
yeah, I mean, well, one thing that's very true is when we turn up to sound people in general, I find, even if they're good at their job, tend to be very lazy. And so you'll turn up to a show and they won't have looked at your tech spec ahead of the gig.
And of course not.
Yeah, exactly. Of course not. And we can be a bit intimidating for a sound engineer who's maybe used to doing four-piece rock bands. because we'll turn up and we're like, yeah, we have a keys player. He's got three separate keyboards. And also there's a sax player over this side. And I think that, oh, and we've got an SPDSX with samples at the back. And that can be a bit scary. And we make that easy because our keyboard player has like a pedal board, and the DI boxes are actually cut into the pedal board and all labeled up. So all they have to provide is three XLRs. And our sax player is actually on his own in-ears.
Right.
So he doesn't take a monitor mix. And again, he's got a little mixer on his pedal board, so they just have to provide an XLR to that. So we're easy to deal with in that sense. But, you know, certainly the more complicated the band, the more intimidating it is for a sound engineer. So as soon as you're on in-ears, you're taking a lot of that away from them, especially if you're dealing with using your own mixer to feed the band their monitor mixes.
And I guess a more consistent performance for you just makes it better for turning up in gigs and not have to worry about what it's going to be like when you get there.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. That's definitely a thing to consider. I don't think there's anything. There's almost a bit of I think it's a bit macho, isn't it, to sort of be anti in ears. But there's definitely an advantage to just performing better, giving a better show.
I think all that technology's just got so much better, though, hasn't it? For guitar players, you know, all of that stuff has just got so much better and so much easier and so much more affordable, like obtainable.
Well, I was going to say, but not cheaper. I mean, it's still, you think if you need, what do you need? So you've got to get your in-ears, you've got to get your pack, and then what, you've got to get your router box. What are you looking at? I don't know, $2,000 a band member?
No, I don't think it's that much money. I'm not going to sit here and Google it right now.
No, sure.
I'm pretty sure. I don't think it's that expensive. But I think probably a lot cheaper than the insane amounts of money it was, obviously, sort of 10, 15 years ago when that technology was like brand new.
Yeah.
And I guess the same as things like Helix and stuff and multi-effects, like you say, like the price has come down massively and the quality has got so good, and what people can do for the money as well. And you're seeing a lot of, remember the first time we saw like Moore pedals in the shop, and now you're seeing like brands, you know, that almost come, you know, cheaper than Moore, that are making multi-effects with full color touch screens for like $200.
Yeah, was it Valiton that put out one recently? And I saw it and I was like, I mean, this looks pretty good. We got that Moore one for guitar notes. I think they sent that to us. And it was great, you know, for what it was, it was fantastic.
I mean, you know, I think side by side personally against a lot of the, you know, the big guns, as it were, I think there is a sound difference and a quality and a feel difference.
Absolutely.
But in terms of, you know, again, breaking down the barriers of price to make things more accessible for a range of players, I mean, it's just crazy, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly, I know this is the case with all of the multi-effects companies, but with Line 6, just because it's the one that I experienced with them, the amount of updates and new features, new pedals, new ways of using the pedal that they keep adding, when the only time I paid for it was when it came out, you know, whenever that was now, 6-7 years ago. It's you know, they keep improving it without any spend, so it means people coming into it now, if you buy the multi effects of your choice once, and all those companies are adding new stuff all the time.
So
you get a bunch more free stuff for it, which is so the pedal you invested in a while back just keeps getting better.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's, you know, and that's important now as well, isn't it? It's like that ongoing support, that sort of, you know, value for money
type
thing, isn't it?
But for me, it, you know, it comes back to the fact that I did try Helix. I did try like to use the GT1000, and it came back to the fact that me and Tim just wanted simple old school amps behind us, and actually all we wanted was effects, and having all that other stuff almost is option paralysis-y a bit. And so for us, the MS3, for a start, one of the things that certainly put us off about the Helix LTs when we got them was that they're plastic, and I don't know how rugged that's going to be. It doesn't fill me with confidence, things like that. And so having a proper big metal chassis MS3 that's indestructible, and me and Tim are using the same ones that we used since we shot that video with you, Matt.
God, which was like, what, 2017?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, 2016 maybe even. But, you know, it was a long old time ago. We're still using the same ones. Sure, some of the buttons have fallen off of mine now and I've butchered on foot switches from other effects pedals. But, you know, it's the amount it's been gigged and they're still going strong, still providing all the tones that we need. And it's not like we even stick to stuff. Every time we're making a new record, we're dialing back into the MS3 and finding new things. Because that's kind of a thing, isn't it? Once you've found those sounds, you sort of just set and forget. So when you're recording new stuff, it's nice to dive back into the pedal and find new things.
Yeah.
So I still feel like, for as fickle as I am with all gear, the MS3 is the pedal that just keeps giving.
Yeah, I think you're right on option paralysis. I mean, you know, my big board has got a switcher on it and a bunch of pedals and stuff like that. I think, you know, you actually spend so much time programming and find out, saying like, I love this sound, I love this sound, I love this sound. And actually, I tend to find, you know, as much as it pains me to say it, that actually sometimes just picking up two or three pedals and just plugging it in into a tiny pedal board, way more fun and way more enjoyable, rather than like, oh, you kind of keep feeling like you need to change stuff because you've got so many things in front of you, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I can see, you know, I can see the thing about, and then, yeah, when you go down to it, you might dive into it and you might find a bunch of other stuff again in the future. But a couple of pedals and set and forget, you know, don't get me wrong, I love having a big pedal board, but ultimately, you know, just a couple of pedals every now and then, which was good for me when I started to pack up my house, getting ready to move. And I filled four
trucks.
Four 32 litre storage boxes just with pedals.
Wow.
I've then filled a further 10 11 litre storage boxes with just bits and pieces and cables and machines that go beep. Then I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pedal boards.
Unbelievable.
And then I've got some like under the bed storage boxes, which have just got gear that's too big to fit in like normal storage boxes. And then 4 60 litre storage boxes just with the boxes. Because you can't throw away a pedal box. So yeah, somehow it's all got to go somewhere. Yeah. And yeah, that's before I even start packing up guitars and stuff. It's just like, oh my God. It's just ridiculous.
It's going to take you forever.
Indeed. But, yeah, sounds like a good tour overall, Joe. Sounds like a good tour.
It was. It was good. It was gear filled. Everything was reliable. Everything worked. Nothing broke across, you know, a two-week tour, which is very good. So, you know, all in all, I'm extremely happy with it. Just, I want to talk about, because you went to a gig, Matt, to see Sixth. I want to talk about that, but just before I do, I'll come back to that Irish band that we were playing with called Bicurious, just because I want to talk briefly about a very interesting guitar setup. Two-piece, the guitarist playing a Stratocaster, and it was the best amp setup and pedal setup ever. So he's using a gig rig, one of the big gig rig switches and a handful of pedals on his board. Yeah. But the amp setup is two Roland JC40s.
Nice.
To either side of the stage. And then he was using a bass rig, my bass rig actually, but with his own EBS bass head to send like an octave down bass signal to. The sound was huge. Just the idea of having the stereo amps, and he was ping-ponging between them. He had it like, it was a stereo set, so he could do the wall of sound thing, but he was doing stuff with like slapback delays where the amps were going shabba, you know, on each side. Mm-hmm. You know, it was very, very clever. Very, for a two-piece, I've never seen anyone make as much noise and make that noise as fun. You know, two pieces have come a long way since Royal Blood, you know, started running a bass through a couple of guitar amps. This was clever, intelligent, well thought out, And I, you know, Strats aren't the biggest sounding guitars, but it was perfect for them because it gave him the it was so articulate, but so heavy as well because of what it'd done for it. And the JC40s just sounded absolutely amazing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for me, JC40s, I mean, I've got a JC22, but JC40, you know, just really clean, you know, allows you to run a lot of pedals through it. Got to be careful a couple of times with the old drives. Sometimes drives can get a bit tough, you know, they can be a bit top-endy through a JC40, but ultimately they are a really good clean pedal platform.
Yeah, I absolutely fell in love with the amps seeing him use them every day. And also just because they're relatively lightweight, easy to transport. They're just a two-piece, so, you know, they've got to bring all this gear. It was great.
Lovely.
But anyway, let's talk about the gear of Sixth, because you went to see them recently.
I did indeed. So for any listener who isn't familiar, because they were certainly, I would say, bigger in the UK than they were big in America. But basically, Sixth are the original. Maybe that's quite strong. I'll get slaughtered for that. But one of the kind of really early, like, tech metal bands that effectively were one of the two founding pillars of djent music. Yes. You have Meshuggah on one side, 8 strings, down-tuned, very tech, you know, kind of wall of sound. And then you basically had Sixth, whose first record, Death of a Dead Day, came... No, was Death of the Dead Day the first one? No, that was the second album. The Trees Are Dead and Dried Out and Waiting for Something Wild was the first record in 2003. It was self-produced, and it really was a game changer in terms of guitar playing, because it was odd time signatures. It was sort of really heavy, what we know now as djenty guitar sounds that were very down tuned, but so much like technical prowess in terms of, like, that, you know, the two guitarists, Dan Weller and Pin, were just doing stuff that people just weren't doing playing guitar in 2003. I mean, I think I first discovered them in 2005 when I first moved to Brighton. And I saw them a couple of times in Brighton, just absolutely mind blowing. They're in Guitarist magazine a couple of times. And then they did a second record in 2006. And then they basically went on, like, hiatus. But in that period, you effectively had Misha Mansour of now Periphery basically being one of the lead people on the Sixth forum on, you know, somewhere on the internet. And that's where he was putting all his mixes. And obviously Periphery, and even he said, like, they were, like, the most influential band in terms of his playing and his style. And obviously you see that everywhere on Instagram now, that kind of playing style, those kind of riffs. And they were doing it like 20 years ago. And I just watched it and I was just in awe of, like, how good and, like, still how fresh all the songs sounded. And how everyone there knew all of the words and, and, you know, not even that. And I think we've talked about it before, Jay, but when a band can write a riff or a guitar part that people sing the guitar part or know specific guitar parts, there's, like, all these tiny little runs and, like, odd, like, dissonant, like, notes that people were, like, singing, like, in between the actual, like, vocal bits. It was... Yeah, absolutely just a mind-blowing gig. It was their 20th anniversary. They did 3 20th anniversary shows where the audience got to vote for the set list before the show. So every show had, like, well, every show was the same set list, but it was an absolute banger of a set list. And it just made me realise, like, how good that guitar sound was and how good they were doing it before everyone else, basically. Sure. And it must be well weird for them now doing stuff that they're just seeing, like, obviously there's, like, people that are even more technical out there now, but they were just doing this technical heavy metal that no one else was doing. And when I first saw them live, they were playing the same two guitars they played on Saturday, which was
Black Machines, isn't it?
Pin was playing a Black Machine and Dan Weller was playing a PRS, which I think he's played for... I think, because I remember there was a video they did in Guitarist magazine, like 2004, which was like really in the early days. In fact, it was before YouTube, but it was when Guitarist magazine used to come with a DVD. And then you put that in and like the video lessons and everything they did was on the DVD. Back when you could send a DVD for free with a magazine. And yeah, he had a PRS where I think he taped up the neck pickup. And then, right. Pin played a Black Machine. And then they were both running through diesels.
Yes, big, you know, big diesel amp users. But Black Machine, such a small company, probably one we've never mentioned on the podcast.
No, and, you know, you don't really see a lot of people using that. They are still a brand. Black Machine, I guess, most recognizable for their headstock. Their headstock is like a reverse hockey stick, I guess you would say in some ways.
The strings pass over nothing at some point, if that makes sense, stylistically.
Yeah. Yeah, basically you've got, and I'm sure someone said that it was something to do with sound or string vibration at some point, but I'm like, I'm not so sure.
But they're very much the sort of thing, they're that clean, bound metal guitar that's become very popular. That simple heavy metal guitar that I think Ibanez have done a lot of, maybe Ormsby to an extent, the Sonars, things like that. Is that kind of vibe of something very heavy but very simple. The new era of metal guitars, you know, it's no longer plastic coated flying K's with Floyd Roses. It's now just about being rugged.
Well, actually, interestingly, I am on the Black Machine website and they are actually closed for orders. And it looks like he hasn't actually had an available guitar since March 2019.
Oh, wow.
So maybe not around anymore. But yeah, they were basically still using the same guitars. They didn't change guitars for the entire set. And I'm pretty sure that while they were had diesels, they also had Helixes on stage as well. And yeah, just this kind of brutal guitar sound, loads of like, and just to me as a guitar player, more like just watching just the technical aspects of what they were doing and going, man, can't believe how ahead of their time it all felt.
Yeah.
You know, like all this two-handed tapping stuff, all these odd time signatures. And then even more so, I think is influential is James Leach, the bass player's bass sound. Because it is the epitome of like what you know now as the modern metal, like ultra punchy bass sound. It's just like And then when he does loads of slap and like tap stuff, and you know how like it almost just sounds like a guitar, basically.
Percussive. Oh right, I see.
Super percussive, super percussive. But yeah, it really felt like, I guess the way I liken it, the only thing I always think of is that like Dingwall modern, you know, and then Dingwall and Dark Glass, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
To effectively have a guitar that's tuned an octave lower. But the stuff he was doing again, I was like, man, you don't realize that how crazy that was. Like 20 years ago. So it was an amazing gig, just amazing music. And it was great to see them again. It's the third time I've seen them. And yeah, it's like a 15-year gap between the two gigs. But definitely a band. If you haven't listened to them, but you do like Periphery and Animals as Leaders and all of that stuff, then you must go and listen to Sixth, S-I-K-T-H.
They are very good indeed. Now, Matt, the next part of it, we've got a choice, okay, for the next bit of the podcast. We can talk about the Reverb bestsellers, which we've been promising to do the last couple of weeks, or we can talk about some things from the news of the week. Do you have a preference?
I think we should do Reverb I think everyone's seen the lists, but everyone is on tender hooks waiting for our opinion of this list that they've already read
times. I don't know if everyone's read these lists. I don't know if everyone bothers with these. And certainly, where's the fun in a list, dear listener? Isn't it more exciting when me and Matt are tearing that list apart?
Absolutely. I think what's interesting with these lists, they actually did a whole bunch of ones. Obviously, the ones we're most interested in are effects and guitars. They've done an amp one, but I think the amp one is less... I think actually the amp one is quite telling of where the world is in terms of things. But actually the guitar one and the effects one are very, very interesting. Well, where do you want to start,
let's get
Joe?
Through them all. So let's start at the top. So the guitars, they've done... This is great. They've done best-selling guitars released in 2022.
That's our gear of the list. That's how we do gear of the year. What's in gear of the year.
But they've also done best-selling guitars of 2022, which is great and important because, of course, so much of Reverb is pre-owned stuff, so it's good to see how that stuff's... So it's good to see how pre-owned stuff does against new stuff, interestingly, because best guitar of 2022 would include new releases and old releases.
Well, yeah, best guitar. So just for listeners, the rankings I put together are total order count. That's number of items, not price. And then anything that was exclusive to Reverb is not in those rankings.
Right.
So that could be individual sellers, bricks and mortar, guitar makers. Rankings include all sales, whether brand new or used. But of course, as you say, Joe, released in 2022 is mainly going to be new. But there's a few interesting things in there. I think the one that... I mean, I'd love to know the actual numbers. Obviously, the actual numbers aren't in here. But at number five, the Tim Henson signature. A man that, the as Ibanez, we were talking about,
yeah.
as talking about tech, the Ibanez TOD-10N TKF.
Which is his sort of Spanish-style acoustic electric.
I mean, that is mad, really. When you think about it, it's like it's not even... like an electric guitar. It's a nylon strung with barely any body to it. It's really thin. The sound hole is on like the upper belt.
Also, I hate this guitar and I hate that band and I hate Tim Henson, but you know, those personal opinions aside, this is great because I tell you what, there aren't any 65-year-old fellas buying the Ibanez Tim Henson signature Spanish acoustic. This is all kids and young people buying that guitar, and how lovely to see someone who is a young player who's influential to young players having such an influence on the industry, rather than, you know, another Joe Bonamassa Les Paul that's going to be bought by a bunch of 70-year-old collectors. Like, you know, this is it's great to see something that they're getting behind. I mean, obviously, in my opinion, Tim Henson and the people buying this guitar have terrible tasting guitars, but great that they're picking up a guitar. I can't knock that.
I think what's interesting is the one below that in sixth place is the George Harrison Rocky Strat. So it's amazing to see you've got in this whole list. And if dear listener, you want to see the whole list, you can go to reverb.com and you can read the entire list from top to bottom. We'll pick out a few of our favorites, Joe, but I mean, it's amazing to see such that mix. But of course, number one at the top, PRS SE Silver Sky, released this year and the biggest selling guitar of not only biggest selling guitar released this year, but also the biggest selling guitar on Reverb this year.
Yeah, won two categories. They must have moved a lot of units of that. And what a great idea. I mean, by PRS, you know, put aside again my very well-documented opinions on this guitar and the artist that it's attached to. Brilliant work by PRS. Released the guitar, £2,200 custom, you know, big proper PRS thing. Released a few custom colours and things like that. Let it sit there for a couple of years and then, bam, make it affordable. and released a bunch of great colours. And it's obviously, from a marketing perspective of releasing guitar, they've done an incredible job and people have lapped it up. The opportunity to own a Silver Sky. And of course, they made a few changes with the SE, didn't they? They've lost the 7.25 inch radius, which would have been maybe one of the most off-putting things for people, as it's such a taste thing.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, you're right, though. It's making that thing unobtainable, learning how to make that guitar and then going, okay, now we can make a cheaper one. And actually, there's a fact on here, Joe, which I missed the first time I read on this list, which is bonkers. So last year, the original Silver Sky, so the American-built PRS Silver Sky, outsold all American-made Fenders on Reverb. Which is just, yeah, which is just absolutely crazy. Think how many they're shifting over that. Yeah. And while that's no longer true this year, the Made in Indonesia SE Silver Sky outsold all other guitar models on Reverb, no matter where in the world they were built.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah, so you've got SE Silver Sky Fender Player Strat at number two, actually.
Oh, you're doing the other list now.
I'm just sort of... Oh, they're very similar, Joe.
So the Player Strat, so in biggest selling electric guitars of 2022, not ones that were necessarily made this year. Certainly the year of the Strat. I mean, if we want to talk about the top four of the top five in best selling electric guitars of 2022 are all Strats. Silver Sky in at one, Player Strat in at two, Professional Strat in at three, Silver Sky, the proper one, in at four, and then, yeah, Player Telecaster gets in at five. But my goodness, we're in a very stratty time period, aren't we? I'd love to see what shop sales are like on boat shoes and white chinos.
Yacht rock, which is a term that I've discovered recently, yacht rock. But yeah, I think what's interesting is you've basically got, and then you go down from that, Gibson 50 and 60 standard, American Professional Tele, and then you're just seeing this like barrage of basically Squires, which is amazing. You know, there's a few more Gibsons dotted in there, but apart from that, it's all of the cheaper, I mean, American Standard Strat's still in there, but J-Mascus Jazzmaster, Affinity Strat, Classic Vibe 60s Jazzmaster, 50s Tele, Classic Vibe, Squire Affinity Tele. I mean, obviously they're much cheaper, so they're going to sell in quantities. Sure, but you think, Squat, you know, a PRS SE Silver Sky outsold a Squire Affinity Tele. The only, effectively, it's either Squire, Fender, Gibson, or PRS. Mm-hmm. Apart from an ESP LTD EC1000, which is the
Les Paul, classic, the Eclipse. Yeah.
the classic Eclipse ESP that is basically a Les Paul.
Well, what struck me is there are basically no modern guitars. Very few modern guitars making their top 20 there.
No, everything's very traditional. Few. Very
considering
few.
How powerful, how what a big genre metal is at the moment, it's interesting to see how much, you know, Strats, Offsets, and Tellies are dominating the list. Fender and Squire obviously completely dominating, but, you know, really traditional guitars absolutely dominating Reverb at the moment. I don't necessarily think that's because they're more popular. I think maybe there's more choice, or maybe sort of modern metal guitars people are more likely to buy from a smaller luthier or something like that. So there's, you know, different things. Whereas if you want a Strat, you want a Fender, you know. Well, actually, I guess that's not the case with the PRS. Bad example. If you want a Jazzmaster, you probably want a Fender Jazzmaster, you know.
Absolutely. And then I think what's super interesting, just moving down to the next part, Joe, because this is obviously a contentious spot for this one, because some would say it's a guitar, some would say it's a bass. The best-selling bass guitars of 2022, number one, Squire Classic Vibe Bass 6.
Unbelievable. I mean, goes to show how much impact the Beatles Get Back documentary has had on the industry.
Oh, well, I would say personally, it's guitar nerds going all the way back 10 years ago when we were like, best thing you'll ever buy, mate. Gear of the year. And then people have been hanging on our every word ever since.
Yeah.
John Lennon, rubbish. No, but I think definitely... I mean, it's an odd instrument, isn't it? Realistically, it's an odd instrument, but it's been made affordable. It plays really, really well. It sounds really good straight out of the box. And it's just a bit of fun for not a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah. They're fantastic. I mean, the bass list I thought was really interesting. The fact that there isn't a jazz bass in the list until number 9. Dominated, in fact, by short scales and P basses for the whole upper list. Interesting to see Rickenbacker 4003s so high up on the list, considering...
Still a classic.
How hard they are to find. Stunning Stingrays. So Stingray seems to be popular again, getting in at number 6, which is fantastic. Lovely to see the Bronco bass make an appearance at 8, which I assume was us.
I tell you what's interesting, and again, I guess maybe you could work out, like, realistically how many units they're talking of, because with the bass one, I guess bass players start to run out of ideas, because you've got the kind of classic Ibanez SR300 E, which is their kind of the classic Ibanez sort of modern-ish bass, I guess you would say. The Hofner Ignition Pro Violin bass, yeah, I get that. And then... Fender Precision Bass 1970 to 1983.
I love it. You don't get that in any of the guitar lists, do you? Because you guitarists, you're less tasteful than us. We're still buying vintage gear. Vintage gear makes it into our top list. You can have your John Mayer signature models, guitar players. We'll buy the good old vintage basses.
But I think what's amazing there, so Fender Precision Bass 1970-1983, number 11 in four string instruments, a top product. Just looking at some of the prices here, $2,450, $4,500, $2,400,
$3,200.
You know, that's not cheap.
No.
You know, they're still selling in that quantity. It just goes to show how good, you know, those basses were.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they definitely are. I think it's been a really interesting year, more interesting than anything else, than any other year I've seen things. You know, it's not a lot of stuff that's, to my taste, is making top lists here. I mean, it goes to show how much Fender are dominating at the moment. I'm really glad that it's all classic gear. But it's interesting to see how it's going. Coming back to that first list, the best selling gear of this year, the Classic Vibe Baritone Custom Telecaster in at number 2. How cool is that? That's the second best selling new product of this year, baritone Telecaster. Like, and you've seen those baritone tellies, like they're 60s style bound telly with a rosewood neck, but it's a baritone. What an incredibly cool product.
I think that's the thing, though, isn't it? It's like, what do you sell a guitar player who already has everything?
Yeah.
You know, guitars, you know, and equipment has just become so accessible in the last, like, 10 years. And price has come down, but quality has increased. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've got... 12 guitars here, you know, a couple of them are really expensive, but most of them are sort of like averagely priced. And I sort of go, if I want to buy another guitar, what do I really buy that's different? Do you know what I mean? Go, oh yeah, baritone. You're like, yeah, but you know, you used to look at baritones and you used to go like, oh, I don't really want it to be like a metal guitar or stupidly expensive. And you go, actually, this looks like a telly. It just sounds slightly deeper, and it's like 360 quid. I mean, it's, in some ways, I find it a stroke of genius, because I'm just like, why wouldn't you?
I guess that's a really good point that you touched on there, Matt. There are a lot of guitars in this list that are the sort of instruments that people take a punt on. Like, there are a few guitars here that are people going, yes, this is my ultimate guitar. Most of them are people being like, yeah, I do fancy that, and that is a good price.
But that's where Squire are winning, I think, at the moment.
Absolutely. It's just the range of equipment that they're putting out is
crap, which is, you know, I think if you put out a bunch of guitars like that and they were all rubbish, people would slowly cotton on, these aren't very good guitars.
Well, I mean, we didn't all used to buy Squires, you know?
No, it's, absolutely.
It's definitely how well they're doing.
Had Squire on a headstock and went, oh, I can't go out with Squire on a headstock. But in terms of new guitars, one thing that I think is really interesting, and I think this is a great guitar, is the Guild Surfliner. Is right and bang in the middle of the list.
Wait, what? The Guild Surfliner is in the list. That is That is insane. Yeah.
Right in the middle of the list, number 10 of gear released this year, selling on Reverb.
Explain it to the listener, because I don't think the Surfliner is... it's obviously a popular guitar, but explain it
to... Well, maybe it's all Ryan from 60 Cycle Hum on this one, but yeah. It is effectively, I guess, a mixture between a kind of Strat and maybe an offset with a hardtail through body. HSS, some sort of vintage rocker switches on the upper horn for your kind of pickups on and off, volume tone, mixture between the kind of classic Sears Woolworths kind of instruments, but maybe with a, you know, kind of more modern vibe.
To the price, I think, is one of the things that makes it easy.
I mean, it's crazy. An average of sort of 389, 379.
In pounds.
Guild really... really making an impact there, I think, which is great. And I mean, yeah, you only have to look at the transaction history and go back for 2022. I mean, you can count how many guitars are on here. I probably won't do it on the podcast, but there's sort of like, I guess, about 10, 11 products per page, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4 pages, so 44 plus 1, 2. So it's nearly 100 guitars. So let's just say best-selling new guitars this year, Guild Surfliner in at number 10, around 100 sales on Reverb.
Wow.
So gives you an idea of where the other ones may fall. Yeah. But yeah, an interesting year. Should we look at pedals?
I think we should do that over on the Patreon exclusive episode of the podcast.
Keep those people waiting.
Yeah, we've come up to time on this week's episode, so let's talk about effects pedals and amplifiers over on this week's Patreon. Dear listener, come over and join us. It's patreon.com/guitar nerds. You can become a supporter for as little as $1 a month. At the dollar tier, you'll get this episode ad-free and early. But if you want that extra episode, then you'll need the $5 tier. You can also join a $10 tier of Super Mega exclusive people. Get all the benefits, and I'll sing you a song at the end of every week's episode. Find us on all your favorite social media platforms. Join the Guitar Nerds group on Facebook, which is where the bulk of our discussion takes place. Thanks for listening. You've been lovely. We've been the Guitar Nerds. Farewell.
Goodbye.
Listen to me, guitar, your guitar nerds, the guitar, your guitar nerds, guitar, your guitar nerds, the guitar, your guitar nerds.
The Sonic Pickups, Suresh, Chris Franklin, Anton Fry, and Barry Gresbick, Steve Davis, Danny Walker, Jorrit Brown, Andy Hoffler, Holly Simpson, John Conway, Russell Healing, Paul True, Peter Pesh, Ty Allen, Yogi the Guitarist, Sean Hughes, Brian Hansen, Eric Emma, Jeffrey Wax, Brian Einzler, Gavin Van der Linden, Andy Manley, Mark Lizao, Katowacki, Simon Milbourne, and Stuart Robson, Eric File, Joe Prattick, James Dorr, Abe Matthews, the band, Russ Edwards, Stephen Burke, Dave Lee, Jane Gray, Scott Kennedy, Christopher Loset, Derek Rich, oh, Blake Wyland, Rob Nordvink, Janie Schumann, Steve Merkel, Annie McKenzie, Brad Page, Robin Smith, Scott O'Brien, Paul Connigan, and Mark Gravitt.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.